1:50 p.m. Daniel could still hear the hammering echoing through the upper half of the house, a mean, destructive clatter that seemed to chip away at his very skull, an invisible spike attempting to break through to his brain. When he reached the first floor, Daniel paused, one hand on the knob at the end of the stair rail. He closed his eyes, trying to push an image from his mind. Claire, her twisted and bloody body wrapped in metal, the engine puffing steam around her. One eye closed, one eye open, the pupil dilated, burst blood vessels mixing with the beautiful blue iris, staining it purple. That glazed eye, staring out through the wreckage at nothing, seeing nothing, sensing nothing. Gone. Gone forever. Daniel choked back a sob, instantly furious with himself. Every time he cried, it was as if the last bit of Claire he held inside him were draining out, spilling to the ground, lost. He wanted to hold the tears in, to hold her in, close to his heart. Instead, they slipped free, his daughter with them, the vacuum of space within him growing larger, consuming him, his heart, his soul. What had once been a paradise was now a black abyss, the vastness of space without a single star to light the way. "I want her back," he pleaded with the darkness. "I want my daughter back. I know you have her. I'll do anything, anything. Just give her back. Give her back to me." It was pointless, he knew. She was dead. There was no coming back. But the house had, hadn't it? This goddamn abomination of a house had become alive out of sheer will. It had twisted itself into their lives from miles away, like an invisible vine creeping across the country, into their houses, into their families, into their minds. "It has Claire. It told me it has her. If it is holding her, it can release her." Daniel closed his eyes. "Please give her back," he whispered. The void surrounded him. Silent. Infinite. Without warning, a jolt rocked his body, electricity coursing through him from head to toe. His thick fingers clutched the railing, nails digging into the wood as the sensation overtook him. His first thought, his only thought, was that this was the heart attack his doctor had always warned him about. Then came a flash of images. Claire as a baby, held in Sabrina's arms. Claire's baptism, riding her first bicycle, cheering with the junior high varsity squad, with her date for winter formal. They were snapshots he knew well, filed away in a photo album somewhere, back at his house in Chicago. But these were more real than those flat, lifeless photographs. These were three-dimensional, a strange sense of motion given to the images. Claire's eyes blinked. Her smile widened. He could almost hear her laugh. At the back of his skull, his brain hot like an electrical socket, a voice crackled through curtains of ancient whispers. "You could have saved her." And then it was over. His body released from whatever had taken hold, the electric shock dissipating from the very ends of his hair, the tips of his stubby fingers. A low sigh escaped him from the deepest corners of his lungs. Around him, the house's wooden joints began to creak, as if the building were being gently rocked on its foundation by the almost undetectable sway of a minor earthquake. It lasted only a few seconds. Then the movement ceased, order restored. He stood at the bottom of the stairs, the house quiet around him. The wind picked up outside, whistling through a crack in a wall. Daniel took a few short breaths, testing his body, making sure everything was working normally. He felt no pain, no shortness of breath, no tightening in his chest. Whatever that was, whatever had passed through him was gone. From high above came a thud, and the entire house seemed to shudder. Daniel cocked his head, attempting to locate the sound. It was within the walls, hidden. A second thud followed the first, then a faint, steady squeak. He recognized it now. Gears turning. Machinery at work. Watching the area just to the left of the staircase, Daniel imagined a system of gears and belts turning, sending something down to him. When the squeaking reached the first floor, a third thud echoed through the foyer as the machine came to a stop. It hit him in an instant, embarrassing in its obviousness. The elevator. He moved farther into the foyer, and the iron accordion door of the elevator came into view. Through the grate, Daniel could make out the rich wood walls of the elevator car. It must have been at the top floor when they arrived. Something triggered it just now. An electrical surge, perhaps, and it descended. Except there is no electricity, Daniel realized. We tried the switches ourselves. The juice is off. Daniel tried to view the entire car. It seemed empty, but the patchwork of iron partially obstructed his view. There could be something in there. A shadow. An occupant. Daniel touched hesitant fingers to the accordion door. Took a breath. Cautiously collapsed it open. The elevator was empty. Just to be sure, he searched the entire car from floor to ceiling, finding nothing except... Daniel cocked his head, confused. The light at the center of the ceiling was on, its opaque glass cover glowing from within, silhouetting the corpses of dead bugs piled at the bottom. So there was power. They must have been mistaken. Maybe the breakers for the lights were off, but the elevator had never been shut down. It was a long shot, but it was the only explanation that made sense. He was faintly aware of his feet moving, carrying him forward into the car. His hand reached out and grasped the accordion door, pulling it closed. There were buttons before him, three in all, stacked atop each other like the shimmering spine of a distant constellation. He pressed the top button. 3. He waited for those familiar sounds to return. The squeaking of gears, the thud as a chain was pulled taut. But there was only silence. And then the elevator was moving, the foyer vanishing from sight as Daniel passed between floors. The second-story hallway appeared, Sebastian's scuffed black shoes visible at the far end, Sam's back jutting out from around the corner. The elevator continued to rise without a sound. No heads poked out from the alcove. No startled eyes watched as Daniel ascended past them. Up, 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 he went, higher into the house. The last sliver of light from the second-story hall slipped across the floor of the elevator. Then it was extinguished. Darkness enveloping Daniel, the criss-cross pattern of the accordion door barely visible before him. He should have been frightened by this journey. Yet there was no fear, only the sense that he was being drawn toward something good, to a very special place the house had reserved only for him. A goofy grin spread across Daniel's face, his cheeks still wet with the tears he had shed at the foot of the stairs. The stop came suddenly. Daniel placed a hand against the wall of the car to steady himself. On the control panel, the lighted third button blinked off, announcing his arrival. No, Daniel whispered. He pushed the accordion door open. Just as Wainwright had said, there was a brick wall here, too. Daniel felt his stomach drop. With a trembling hand, he reached up and touched the bricks. Instantly they crumbled. The top row went first, then the next and the next, the bricks falling away from him like a breaking wave. Just like the elevator, they made no sound as they crashed to the floor. The doorway was open. Daniel squinted in warm sunlight. His grin widened, the carefree smile of a drunken man. With an almost irrepressible sense of excitement, he stepped out of the elevator and into the third floor bedroom. 30. 2:07 p.m. At the top of the stairs, Wainwright and Moore continued pounding the brick wall. They had been at it for almost an hour, coming down only to dig through the canvas bag in hopes of finding a utensil that would finally do the job. "It's not working," Sam thought. He tried to swallow and found that his throat had constricted. The chisel and sledge had knocked a few chunks of mortar loose, but the bricks held tight. It was a miraculous thing, the barrier, hastily built over 2 decades ago, impervious to harm. Sebastian was just outside the alcove, pacing nervously in a small circle.
"Maybe we should just go," he suggested.
Sam shook his head. "You know we can't do that."
"I know," Sebastian admitted.
There was a heavy sense of resignation in his voice. Moore trudged down the stairs, the sledgehammer held out in both hands. "The bitch isn't budging." Her face was caked with gray dust, streaks of sweat cutting dark rivers down her cheeks. "Your turn." The offer pleased Sam. Standing around watching was making him feel more and more helpless. He took the hammer as Moore slipped down onto the bottom step. At the top of the stairs, he settled in next to Wainwright, who pounded the edge of the chisel with fading strength. Sam reared the sledgehammer back and slammed it into the bricks with all his might. The enthusiastic show of muscle seemed to encourage Wainwright, who began backing each blow with more power. Soon their attack was perfectly timed, their individual strikes sinking into one sound like the ticking of a monstrous clock. He could hear them through the wall. Clank, 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 like trapped miners desperately fighting for daylight. The irony was almost palpable as Daniel stepped freely from the elevator and into the room. He felt like an astronaut on some distant planet, the first man to walk on its alien terrain. Like the rest of the house, the third floor bedroom was immaculately clean. He traced a finger over the surface of a heavy maple dresser. No dust. There was a single window to his left, the pane no more than 2 feet by 3 feet. Yet the sunlight streaming in was blinding, a warm yellow beam of otherworldly luminance. Hadn't he seen boards over that window last year? Surely he had imagined it. There weren't even nail holes in the perfectly smooth walls on either side of the frame. Beneath the window was a queen-size bed covered in a hand-stitched quilt. Beside the bed, a wheelchair was parked, abandoned, its occupant long gone. Daniel sucked in a mouthful of air. It was impossibly pure, almost alpine. The crisp, cool air one would find at higher elevations, far above the timberline. The clarity of it excited him, tickling his lungs with the hint of frost. Along the wall to his right was a wooden shelf lined with picture frames. Each frame was turned away from the room. Carefully, Daniel flipped the first frame around. It housed a black-and-white photograph of 2 young girls, around 8 or 9 years old, with identical flower-print dresses and black hair pulled into ponytails. They were mirror images of each other, right down to their dour expressions. Daniel turned the next frame. This photograph was beginning to yellow and fade. It was of the girls again, now women in their 30s, flanking an ancient man with a face like cracked, weathered leather. The man had the same gray eyes that they did. This must be their father. The third photograph was more familiar, the sisters posing in front of the house on Kill Creek. One of them was now in a wheelchair, her mysterious accident happening sometime between the second and third photo. So these were the Finches, Rachel and Rebecca. Daniel moved farther into the room. The sunbeam that drifted in through the bedroom window fell warmly on a silver jewelry box. Daniel lifted the lid, and instantly the tinny strains of music flooded out. He recognized it as Bach, although he could not place the concerto. As the tune played, Daniel explored the interior of the jewelry box. It was lined with red velvet, several necklaces hanging from the top portion, a series of small compartments in the lower section housing rings. It was not flashy jewelry, no diamonds or precious stones. Almost all of it was silver, although not a single piece was tarnished. They were as bright and smooth as if they had been polished only moments before. At the edge of the box, where the lid was hinged to the back, something white peeked out. Daniel gave it a light tug. It was paper, yet thick and glossy. His pulse quickened. The excitement, so unexpected, seemed to course through his veins. Each new discovery in this room was his, and his alone. While the rest of them pounded stupidly on the other side of the wall, Daniel was inside. Entry to this secret place was granted only to him. Grasping the sides of the jewelry box with his fingers, he lifted out the inside tray. There, beneath it, was a stack of pictures, devoid of color, their grainy quality harkening back to the early days of photography. They were candid shots of a white-haired woman, her eyes clouded by cataracts, her mouth open slightly as if about to speak. She sat at a round table, hands clasped in those of a man and woman on either side of her. They looked on expectantly, waiting. A medium, Daniel realized. This is a séance. There were only four pictures, all from the same angle, each capturing the same moment with very little time elapsing between them. In each progressing photograph, a smoky, serpentine line emerged farther and farther from the old woman's mouth, stretching out over the table like a ghostly arm. Daniel flipped the last picture over. Penciled at the bottom in small, deliberate print was the word, Grandmama. What a strange lineage the Finches had come from. Finding this house, a place of so much potential power, must have been terribly exciting. Living under this roof, walking these halls each day and night. Surely it did not take them long to realize what they owned. Harnessing its energy would have been their first priority, awakening the slumbering entity that rumor and gossip had invited in. Daniel set the photos back into their secret hiding spot and replaced the inner tray of the jewelry box. He closed the lid, the classical tune that emanated from within instantly snuffed out. Something squeaked behind him. The wheelchair, being nudged forward just a bit. He heard the light scrape of shoes on the floor as feet shuffled in place. Suddenly, Daniel had the overpowering sensation of someone standing behind him, watching him, waiting for him to turn. He felt eyes on him. He listened closely and believed he could hear the whisper of breath being drawn. Balling his hands into fists, preparing for a confrontation, Daniel spun around, his fists instantly unclenched. His heart skittered abruptly, like a needle scratching across a bumped record. At first, the person before him was simply a shadow, silhouetted against the brilliant light of the window. But even before she stepped forward, even before the reflected sunshine fell upon her face, he knew who it was. He could tell by the way the hair fell across her shoulders, by the hint of curves on her budding body, by the trace of perfume, a mix of spice and flowers that permeated the air. The challenge was not guessing the young woman's identity, but believing that it could be true. His mind tried desperately to reject it. There was no way it could be real. It was a trick of the light, a hallucination projected by his grief-stricken mind. His tears convinced him otherwise. They sprang from his eyes like deep, long-hidden water from a cracked stone, washing freely and uncontrollably down. His entire lower jaw began to tremble as if from some abrupt, intense chill. A bubble of saliva popped between his lips as he fought to form the single word that would make it all come true. Claire. A warm smile lit up her face. And now the sunlight began to shift, freeing itself from the sun outside to rotate around her, brightening her, bringing her away from the shadows and into perfect view. It was as if the sun orbited her. She was the center of everything. It was her, his daughter, his Claire, alive. She held out a hand, and on her pinky Daniel saw the ring he had given her two Christmases before, a silver band with a cutout of a cross in the middle. A rosy hue rose to her cheeks, the color of life. Daniel slipped his hand into hers. The warmth confirmed what he already knew, that his beautiful daughter was no longer dead, that she had come back to him, snatched from the cold darkness of the grave by this glorious house. Claire, he said again, the name now leaping freely from his tongue. Still the tears came, his wet cheeks shimmering in the sunshine. She wiped them dry with her thumb. Her lower lip stuck out in a slight pout, poking innocent fun at her emotional father. When she spoke, her voice was not the frog-like croak of the undead, but the sweet, tender song he never thought he would hear again. She said, "Daddy," and the word was pure Claire, love tinged with a hint of teenage sarcasm. Daniel pulled her close to him, hugging her, feeling her arms wrap around his waist. The last of many walls constructed since her death collapsed to rubble, and Daniel sobbed into her shoulder, dampening the lacy white dress. Her funeral dress. We buried her in that dress, that hung lightly on her petite body. "I love you," Daniel cried. "I love you so much, so much, baby. Oh, my God, I've missed you. It hurts so bad." He was rambling, he knew. But there was so much to tell her, so much he had held inside, thoughts he could not share with his own wife, emotions reserved only for the daughter he thought he would never see again. "I've missed you, I've missed you, I've missed you." "I know," Claire cooed into his ear. "But I'm back. Everything can be just the way it was. I can come home to you and Mom. It'll be like nothing ever happened, like I never went away." Daniel tightened his grip on her. Her use of could scared him. It sounded speculative rather than certain. "I want you to come home, sweetie. I'd do anything to have you back. Anything, anything." He felt her lips against the side of her face. "That's good, Daddy. That's perfect." Daniel frowned. The movement of her lips did not exactly match the sound of her voice. The words were lagging behind by a half second or so. And that wasn't the only strange thing. Her voice seemed to be coming from behind her, as if someone were crouching down behind her back and speaking in her voice. "Daddy, are you listening to me?" she asked. Daniel scolded himself for thinking this moment could be anything but miraculous. "It's Claire. It's your daughter. I can come home, but I need you to do something first." Her parted lips did not even seem to move as she spoke. "Anything," Daniel repeated. And he meant it. In his soul, awakened from its comatose state after nearly a year, he meant it. "I can leave this house, Daddy, but you have to do exactly as I say. If you don't, you'll never see me again." The sharp stab of terror tore through Daniel's body. Every molecule threatened to spin free. The thought of losing her again was too much. He couldn't bear it. Not again. Claire pressed her mouth up to his ear, as if fearing the secret words would be sucked away into the vacuum of the bedroom. At first, his mind rejected what she said. It was too strange, too unexpected. He could not do that. Anything but that.
Then she raised a hand to his face, her fingers tracing the edge of his hairline, running through his sandy hair, and that fear sprang back like a striking snake.
You're going to lose her again, and this time it will be forever.
She repeated the instructions over and over. Each time the sting of shock subsided a bit more until they were just words. Ordinary words. He closed his eyes. The only sound he could hear was her voice, Claire's voice, and it was like music, a heartbreaking song recalled from another life. The instructions began again, and now she was slipping something into his hand. A handle, heavy on one end, like the hammers they had used to attack the brick wall at the top of the staircase. The weight of it forced his hand down suddenly, and as if from far, far away, he heard a sound, a chink, like metal biting into wood. Once more she told her father what he must do, and then she pulled away, kissing him lightly on the forehead. Her lips were soft and wet. She was so real. So real. Daniel looked into his daughter's eyes, and she gave him an encouraging smile. "Do it, Daddy," she said, her head cocked, her eyes wide. She smiled, and the words filled his ears, even as her grinning lips remained motionless. "Do it for me."
31. 3:18 p.m. The light was gone in an instant. One moment the warm afternoon sunshine threw a mosaic of colors on the lower half of the staircase. Then it vanished, a gloom overtaking the steps. Sam glanced at Wainwright, who had stopped chipping at the mortar around one particular brick. He set his hammer and chisel down on the top step, wiping his forehead with the sleeve of his shirt.
"I can barely see anything up here," he said.
It was true. Without the sunlight from the alcove window, they were practically working in the dark.
"What's going on out there?" Sam called down to the others.
Moore was standing at the window, peering through the stained glass out to the west of the house.
"Looks like rain," she announced. "Big fat black cloud just passed in front of the sun. Where the hell did that come from?"
There was a sound. Fingers tapping. All over the house.
"What is that?" Sam shouted.
They all listened. Not fingers. Rain. The soft pitter-patter on the roof. Raindrops began to spit at the window pane, obscuring the glass.
"This is pointless,"
Wainwright said, motioning to the wall. His voice was little more than a whisper.
"These bricks must be held in place by something more than cement."
He sighed.
"We're not going to get through with these tools."
"Yes, we will," Sam said.
"I don't know, Sam."
"We will!"
The sudden anger surprised even Sam. He glanced away, embarrassed. Wainwright cleared his throat and waved at the dust swirling about them.
"I need to step outside for a second."
"We don't have time."
"I can't breathe up here,"
Wainwright said pointedly. Clenching his teeth, Sam tightened his grip on the cast-iron skillet. "Hammer," his mind corrected him. But it wasn't. It was the skillet from his mother's stove. He held it by the handle. Its blackened body glistened. Blood. His mother's blood. Sam looked up, startled. Wainwright was hurrying down the stairs. Moore called after him as he passed.
"Check on Daniel, will you? He's been gone a while."
Sam looked down at the object in his hand. It was a hammer. It had always been a hammer. Its head was dented from bashing the hard brick. At the bottom of the stairs, Moore was talking to Sebastian, somewhere in the hall, out of sight. With both hands, she wiped the dust from the sides of her shaved head and stepped out of the alcove. Sam was alone. That's when he heard it, a voice through the wall. He turned and stared at the bricks. It was a woman's voice, muffled by the barrier between them.
"Sammy?"
There was a rush of air and he was back in that kitchen, in his childhood home, the storm raging overhead, his brother and mother fighting, his awful drunk mother yelling abominations, the ugliest words in the English language. Little Sammy was there by the stove, frozen in place, watching helplessly as his mother suddenly slapped Jack, slapped him so hard he fell to the ground. She was on her son in an instant, straddling him, hands around his throat. She was saying what she had said so many times when she was drunk, that she wished she had never had them, that they had ruined her life, that they were a curse. They took her happiness. They deserved nothing but misery. But her words had never felt more potent, more real. Jack's eyes bulged in disbelief. His lips lapped the air stupidly. There was no breath. His mother had made sure of that. Just as she had given the boy breath, she planned to stop it. She was going to kill him. And there was Sam, 10 years old, watching his mother strangle his brother. His beloved Jack, who had taught him to throw a baseball and smoke a cigarette. His brother who called him names and gave him noogies and wet willies. His brother who stood up for him when older boys called Sam a pussy and a fag. Jack's bulging eyes stared desperately at Sam. Burst blood vessels shattered the whites of his eyes into pieces of red-stained glass. End her misery, they plead. End her awful life that she hates so much. End it. Kill her. Kill our mother. Jack's face was turning purple. Sam reached for the nearest object and his fingers found the handle of her cast-iron skillet. He swung it. He knew the second his arm came down that it was too hard. The dull thud of metal on skull was the most horrible sound he would ever hear. The back of his mother's head caved in. Blood splattered little Sammy McGarver's face. Sam stared in horror at the gore-soaked cast-iron skillet in his hand. The impact still reverberated up his arm and into his shoulder. But it wasn't a skillet. It was a hammer. And he hadn't bashed in his mother's head. He had swung the hammer hard against the wall, and a single brick had jostled loose. He pushed the brick with his index finger, and it moved slightly in place.
"More!"
he yelled down the stairs. Moore hurried into the alcove. "What's the matter?" "One of the bricks." Sam stared down at her, his eyes wild. "It moved." Bounding up the stairs, Moore snatched up a chisel and planted its sharp head against the mortar. With her other hand, she whipped the smaller hammer around in a powerful arc and brought it down hard on the butt of the chisel. The sound of the impact was like the chain of a millennia-old beast snapping in half. The brick inched out from the wall. Moore froze. She wasn't sure she could believe what she had just seen. She pounded the back of the chisel again, and again the brick jumped. "Holy shit," she whispered. "We're getting through. This bastard is coming down!" A thin layer of cold sweat swept across Sam's body. Suddenly, he didn't want the wall down. He wanted to pack up the tools and drive far, far away from this house.
"Because you know what's on the other side. You know she's there, waiting for you."
Moore was digging excitedly at the mortar bordering the brick. Grasping it by its edges, she gave it a little tug. It wiggled in place like a loose tooth. A rare smile rose to Moore's face. "Don't just stand there. Help me," she said.
"Leave the wall," Sam's mind warned. "Leave this house."
But Sam knew that he could not do that. Whatever was on the other side, it would end here. At first, the lighter did not strike. Wainwright tried again, flicking a little metal wheel. This time the lighter came alive, a flame flickering in the light breeze. He held it to the end of a cigarette. He heard the faint sizzle as it lit. Sucked in sharply to get the tip nice and red. He exhaled the first puff of smoke, watching it waft out into the cool drizzle. Wainwright leaned against the frame of the back doorway and smoked. The sleeves of his slim-cut linen shirt were rolled up to the elbow, and his arms were covered in a gray dust. He ran his fingers through his shaggy hair, and more dust drifted into the air.
Although he was sheltered here, nice and dry, he could sense the coolness of the afternoon rain, driving the oppressive heat down into the soil. He cocked an ear, trying to make out the sound of Sam's hammering. It appeared the attack on the wall had stopped for the moment. All he heard was the soothing rhythm of raindrops as they spattered the trees and bushes surrounding the house. He had a perfect view of the woods to the south, and the hint of a trail snaking through them. The opening to the path had been obvious last October. Now the foliage was overgrown, making the trailhead difficult to pick out. He took another drag and savored the hint of sweetness in the smoke, rolling it slowly over his tongue before expelling it. His nerves were fried, like the exposed wires of an old garage sale lamp. The cigarette helped, but not much. He was beginning to doubt if coming to Kill Creek would result in the answers they sought. The house had offered nothing since their arrival, not even a supernatural display to confirm their fears. No orbs of light, no ghostly apparitions, nothing. Only a wall that refused to come down. Nothing unexplainable about that. They had rushed back to the middle of nowhere expecting a confrontation with ultimate evil, and had found good masonry instead. Wainwright sucked the last drag from the cigarette, then stubbed it out on the door jamb and flicked it into the yard. It landed halfway between him and the trailhead, a sliver of white in the deep green carpet, like the protruding tip of a fractured bone. He was turning back toward the kitchen, his hand reaching to pull the back door shut behind him, when he caught a glimpse of the girl. It was only that, a glimpse, but in his mind he could still see it. The deep brown skin, the dark hair, obscured by the thick curtain of leaves. He paused, glanced back. She was gone.
"You saw nothing," he told himself. "No one was there."
He wanted to believe this because his first instinct had been something different. His first thought had been,
"There's Kate."
He started to back into the house as he watched the wall of trees for any sign of the girl. The rain pelted the leaves, giving the woods a strange sense of movement, the branches nodding as if encouraging him to explore. There she was again, farther down the trail this time, barely visible through the cover of green. In an instant she was gone again, lost to the dense forest. Wainwright moved out from under the roof's overhang and into the sprinkling rain. His wild hair was instantly wet, clinging like curling fingers of ivy to his forehead. He blinked as the raindrops collected on his eyelashes, wiping at them to keep his vision clear.
"It wasn't her,"
his mind insisted. But it had looked like her. Even in the fleeting glimpses he had noticed that this woman carried herself like Kate. Except there was an odd stutter to her movements, like a film with random frames removed. Pulling the overgrown branches away from the trailhead, Wainwright stepped through the rip in the forest and onto the path. The branches snapped back into position behind him, blocking his way. The message was unintentional, but nonetheless clear. There was no turning back. At first he did nothing. He simply stood at the edge of the trail and continued to scan the area for the girl. The tops of the trees provided momentary relief from the growing storm, their bushy branches deflecting the rain.
"Kate!"
he called out, feeling instantly foolish.
"It isn't Kate. It can't be. It's the bloody house. Or it's nothing. It's your imagination. But what if..."
A sound worked its way to him, beaten down by the steady patter of the rain. He cocked his head, trying to force his ears to separate the noises like audio tracks on a computer, the falling rain on one track, the bristle of blowing leaves on another. And on a third track, a sound he may have imagined. A woman's voice from farther down the trail.
"Oh, here."
He heard it this time. He was sure of it. "Over here," she had said. Even the voice sounded like Kate's, playful yet commanding, each word warmed by that southern twang. He began to walk, hesitantly at first, then driven forward, his feet moving faster as he rounded the first curve in the path.
"Over here," the voice said. "Hurry it up."
It was closer, just around the next bend. Raising an arm to shield his face from the overgrowth, Wainwright burst into a clearing. He expected to find her, waiting for him, smiling warmly. But the clearing was empty save for the creeping vines that seemed to be overtaking the countryside.
Kate?
There was no hesitation now. He called the name with confidence, sure she must be nearby. Only the rain responded, growing in intensity, pounding the cover of trees in an effort to break through. Wainwright walked the edge of the clearing, a complete circle no more than 40 feet in circumference. On one end, opposite where he had entered, was the next leg of the trail, its entrance barely discernible. She must have slipped through just before he arrived, pushing deeper into the woods. He decided to follow the path until he found her. But as he took his first step, something creaked underfoot. He bounced lightly in place, finding that the ground had an unusual give. The creaking became a crack, the sound of weak wood splintering.
The well, he thought, remembering his own warning from their first visit. If I'm not careful, these bards will snap and I'll fall.
It came at him in a flash of light. What little sunlight remained in the day glinting off of metal. The image was too confusing to process. A flashlight? A star? A coin? The possibilities rushed by, unfiltered by reason. Then instinct kicked in, his face flinching, his hand swinging up to block the incoming object. He heard the impact before he felt it, a sickeningly dull thud, like the smashing of a pumpkin. The force of the blow caused him to stumble back a few steps, the rotten boards protesting loudly beneath him. His tongue licked wildly at something that was wedged between his teeth, through his teeth, a metallic object, cold and sharp at its edge. His mouth was wet, too wet, filling with a gushing liquid. Blood. His mind raced, panic shorting out his senses, keeping him from making sense of what was happening. Through this, through the throb that was quickly enveloping his face, through the confusion as his tongue lapped stupidly at the metal edge in his mouth, another sound came to his attention, a whimpering from off to his side.
I'm sorry,
the new voice was saying. It was a man's voice, pathetic and grief-stricken.
I'm sorry,
he said over and over.
I'm sorry.
Without warning, Wainwright was pulled forward, his feet stumbling as the metal object was yanked from his face. His mouth was overflowing with blood. He could feel it coursing down his chin, soaking his shirt.
I'm sorry!
The voice insisted at a near hysterical pitch.
I have to! I'm sorry!
For an instant, the whimpering ceased, replaced by a grunt, as if the man were putting all of his energy behind one action. Wainwright's wild eyes caught a glimpse of the glint again. This time it came at an angle, allowing him to make it out, to see the awful thing that was about to strike him. A blade, flat and tapered, like a sharpened stone. An axe, no, smaller. A hatchet. There was only time for this single thought, and then the impact jerked his head back, his neck bending at an unnatural angle. Something sloughed off the top of his head and it hit the ground with a terrible, soggy splat. Blood was drenching the back of his shirt, and then the darkness consumed him. It was not as he had imagined it. He had expected death to occur in the snap of a finger. But this was the sensation of his mind powering down, like a computer hard drive spinning to a stop. There was only blackness, and then there was nothing. Daniel stared down at the mess he had made, his chest heaving with each breath. The second strike had taken Wainwright's scalp clean off. The clump of hair and flesh lay on the forest floor, wetted by the occasional raindrop. Where the hair had once been, the top of his skull was caved in, the pinkish-gray tone of brain visible through jagged bone. Letting the hatchet slip from his hand, Daniel dropped to his knees, his body quivering as he began to weep.
I'm sorry,
he whispered to the lifeless body.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Wainwright's face was split straight down the middle.
the nasty work of the hatchet's first blow. The blade had bitten deeply into his head, creating a canyon from just below his hairline down to the middle of his mouth. His two front teeth had been knocked in. One was folded up like the landing gear of an incoming plane, while the other hung loosely by a thread of nerves. The blood was more than Daniel could have ever expected. It soaked the earth around Wainwright's head, turning the already mushy ground into a reddish-black swamp. Sitting on his legs, his knees digging into the dirt, Daniel stared at Wainwright's mutilated face, the glazed eyes parted by that terrible slash in the skin. Daniel couldn't look away. He had done this. He had murdered this man, with no warning, with no obvious motive. The light touch of fingers grazed Daniel's shoulder. He peered back at the girl standing behind him. Claire. Even as the storm above grew in strength, she was a beacon of light, a shining star in the gloom. She bent her neck, her head turned down at an odd angle, and her voice seemed to rise up and over her, cascading down her shoulders like mist over a mountain ridge.
Thank you, Daddy.
The sensation of her hand on his shoulder gave him strength. Strength to get back on his feet, to pull the wood planks from the top of the well, to drag Wainwright by the feet and slide him head first into that man-made hole in the earth.
The body, Daniel thought.
That's all it is now. A body. No life. Nothing to mourn. It was simply a means to an end. She was smiling down at him, and the sight warmed his soul. His body stopped shivering. The tears dried up. He was strong again. He could do this. He could finish the job. For her. Daniel shoved over the boards covering the well to expose about 3 feet of the mouth. It was just enough to fit the body through. Wainwright was heavier than he looked, but with some effort, Daniel managed to drag the limp corpse closer so that its feet dangled over the edge. He gripped the young man.
Body, he corrected himself. It's nothing more than that.
By the shoulders, and lifting with his legs as he had always been taught, he tipped the body up until it slid easily over the lip of the well. It plunged into the darkness. As he had with his cell phone 6 months earlier, Daniel listened for the object to splash into the water below. There was no sound. Wainwright was swallowed by the earth. Nearby, Claire giggled. Daniel turned to her. Her head was bobbing up and down with laughter, her lips pulled into a tight grin. But once again he had the feeling that the sound was not coming from her, but from something behind her.
Like a puppet.
No, his mind roared. That is your Claire. Yes, it was his Claire, and her laughter was like breath in his lungs. Daniel bent over and grabbed the carpenter's hatchet by its blood-streaked handle. He wiped the gory blade on his pant leg and started toward the trail that would lead him back. To the house. To them. 32. 3:50 p.m. He was back in his bedroom. Not the cozy, rustic room in his house in upstate New York, but the place he had called home for one night, last Halloween. Sebastian sat down on the bed, just as he had 6 months before. Through the door he could hear the muffled voices of Sam and Moore on the stairs, followed by the pounding of hammers. He should be out there helping them.
What help could you possibly be, old man? You don't even want to be here. None of us want to be here, he said aloud,
but the sound of his own words embarrassed him.
You're a coward.
It was true, although he had no real reason to fear the house. Like the others, Sebastian had returned home only to be struck by inspiration. Like the others, he had spent the past few months pounding away on a keyboard, his fingers barely able to keep up with the story racing through his mind.
But it was different for you.
Yes, Sebastian said to the empty room. He was not driven by terror, as Sam, Moore, and Daniel had been. As he wrote, he became aware of a presence in the house, a figure that lurked at the corner of his vision. But he was not afraid. The further he got into the new book, the closer the figure approached, until one day it put a hand on his shoulder and said in that warm, rough voice, "It's good, Sebastian. It's really good."
"Richard?"
He knew it couldn't be true. Yet every day when he returned to his computer, Richard was there, standing behind him as if waiting for pages to read, just as he had done when he was alive.
"Listen to yourself," his mind ordered. "The thing in the house with you was not Richard. Richard is dead. There's no coming back from that."
"I thought it was my imagination," he insisted.
"You were lying to yourself."
"I know," he said.
He'd gotten more than just Richard back, though. His mind had returned to him, the lapses into dementia growing rarer until they ceased entirely. Sebastian felt more alert than he had in years. He was operating at peak performance, all cylinders firing, as he passionately wrote what could be the best novel of his career. He got up from the bed, his hand on the footboard to steady himself. Slowly he crossed to the bathroom and stepped inside. He flicked the light switch, remembering only when the bulb above did not react that there was no electricity. The bathroom was a cocoon of shadow, the only light falling in through the open doorway. Gripping the pedestal sink with both hands, he stared at his reflection in the mirror. He was a silhouette against the backlight of the bedroom, a featureless black curtain.
"Why are you here?"
he asked the shapeless form before him. He already knew the answer, no matter how badly he wanted to avoid it.
"Because I know it wasn't right. Because I know it wasn't really Richard. It was the house."
That was the reason why, once he had written the last page of his book, he had driven 4 hours into Brooklyn to visit Dr. Adudel. He had to find out what was truly happening to him. Perhaps whatever lurked in the house empathized with Sebastian. After all, they were both old. They were both being forgotten. Maybe what the house was doing wasn't bad. Maybe it was trying to help him. He made the trip to Adderdell's 3 times before the day the others arrived. Only then did Sebastian finally get his answer.
"I'm the storyteller. I never asked to be," he said to his faceless self.
"You didn't have to ask," a voice said from the darkness behind him. "You were chosen." A second form was reflected in the mirror, a shadow among shadows. It was moving closer. Sebastian closed his eyes tight.
"Leave me alone," he said.
He felt fingers brush his neck.
"I gave you everything you wanted," Richard said. "But I can take it back. Unless you leave. Leave this place. Now."
"It isn't Richard."
"Go home, Sebastian. Go home, my love."
"It isn't him."
Sebastian opened his eyes. It wasn't a mirror before him, but a window. And through it he saw warped wooden planks set into the forest floor, beside which lay the crumpled form of Wainwright. He saw the basement, flooded knee-deep, and in the black water floated the body of T.C. Moore. He saw the hallway just outside this bedroom, and sprawled across the ground was Sam McGarver, his face and torso mutilated, a dark lake of blood pooling around him. He saw the front yard and the flashing lights of police cars as bullets ripped through Daniel Slaughter. He saw himself in his garden at home, Richard by his side.
"Leave this place," Richard said.
Sebastian gasped and pushed away from the sink, away from the mirror.
"The mirror? It's only a mirror."
So it was. A simple mirror over the pedestal sink, reflecting his dimly lit face. He looked so old. The color that had warmed his cheeks was gone. Liver spots peeked through thin, receding hair. Sebastian felt something tug at his mind, like fingers pulling a loose thread, threatening to unravel his memories. Sam stood over Moore as her sweaty hands tugged at the brick, inching it slowly away from the wall.
"Just pull the thing out," he barked. "I'm trying. Let me do it. I've got it, McGarver. I've got it."
Moore adjusted what little grip she had, her fingertips slipping as she wiggled the brick back and forth, trying desperately to work it free. It was right smack at the center of the wall.
"If we can get this one out," Sam thought, "we could get a crowbar through. We could pry more bricks loose. Bring this whole damn wall down."
His hands quivered slightly as he watched, his fingers twitching as Moore tried to draw the brick out.
"Just get your goddamn fingers around it and pull," he said, his impatience getting the better of him. "Sam, what do you think I'm trying to do? I've got a quarter of an inch to work with. Just back off, okay?"
Sam did as she said. He glanced around, realizing for the first time that they were completely alone.
"Where are the others?"
"Where's Sebastian?"
"Fantastic," Moore snapped. "We're about to open Tut's tomb, and they're all off playing grab-ass."
There was the loud, abrasive scrape of brick on cement. Sam peered over Moore's shoulder as the chipped red block came out a full inch. It was enough for her to wrap her fingers around each side. Planting a foot against the base of the wall, she leaned back. She sensed Sam there, ready to break her fall should the brick slide easily out. Taking a deep breath, she shoved off from the wall, the brick held tightly in her hands. There was no fear of falling. The wall gave up another 2 inches, but refused to let the brick go just yet.
"Shit!"
Moore barked. She released her grip just long enough to wipe her damp fingers on her pants. As she did, the brick began to wiggle by itself, drawn back into the wall by some phantom force. Her hands were around the brick at once, pulling desperately at it, trying not to lose ground. Each tug was equally matched from the other side as something attempted to keep the wall from coming down.
"Grab my shoulders," she called back.
Sam did, his hands grabbing more roughly. She called out the instructions, her voice rising to a near yell.
"On three, you pull as hard as you can. I'll do the same. One..."
She planted her heel into the top stair, the tip of her shoe pressed hard against the wall.
"Two!"
The veins in her hands bulged, her fingertips bone white. She clamped her fingers around the brick like a vice.
"Three!"
It happened in one fluid motion, Sam heaving Moore back just as she pushed off from the wall, and then they were falling, tumbling down the stairs, the edges of steps scraping their shoulders and backs. They landed at the base of the stairs in a heap. Moore, a jumble of arms and legs beneath Sam, all eyes on the object in Moore's hand. So ordinary in any other situation, so extraordinary here. The brick.
"You did it,"
Sam said with disbelief. Then louder, the excitement palpable.
"You did it!"
And then a wave of dread blew over Sam like a cold wind.
"You did it. You're going to open that wall. And whatever was tugging on the other side of that brick will be there. Nothing between you."
He stared at the brick, still clutched in Moore's hand. Each of their stories had led them to this point, to the secret room beyond the wall, 4 different paths converging at a crossroads, a hidden place not on any known map. They were in uncharted territory. Stepping beyond the staircase into the 3rd-floor bedroom meant giving in to the power of the house, acknowledging its invisible pull on each of them. It had lured them back for a reason. They were about to discover what that reason was. The missing brick left a gaping hole at the center of the wall, black like a necrotic wound. From this, there came a sudden sucking sound, as air was drawn sharply through the gap and into the secret room. A whistling rose to their ears, the air rushing faster and faster. They could feel it passing by them, pulled down the hallway and up the staircase to disappear through that small, brick-sized space.
We have to get the rest of that wall down, Moore said finally. Sam gave a small nod.
Okay.